Hey, Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back with you.
Yes, good to be back with you. It's been a while. Is the weather lifted at all in D.C.? Because it has been really just god-awful here for the last, like, week.
It's bad. It's like the worst April ever. You're in Boston, right?
I'm in Boston, but I mean, this is the first, you know, year we've lived here for a while. You know, in Chicago, you always knew the April sucked.
Mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
April was right around the time that you were looking forward to spring happening, and of course, being in Chicago, it never actually happened.
Right. But, it definitely snowed in April one time when I was in college in Boston.
Right.
So,
my memory about Boston is that you would get reasonably warm weather, and then it would snow once or twice. But then it would quickly go away. On the other hand, the sort of persistent cold rain, you know, this is a little unusual, I think.
No, it's bad. I kind of think the oil companies have tried to just, like, put a damper on global warming talk.
Yes, you know, that's true. It's been interesting, you know, all the, now it's the cold. Although, unless it's a day after tomorrow scenario, maybe that'll happen.
No, sure, right. But, I mean, they're, like, stamping on, like, you know, I don't know if you've seen, I think it's Vanity Fair or something, is Leonardo DiCaprio and a polar bear out there as their current issue. But, because I guess global warming kills polar bears.
Yes, it does.
But wait, this is not one of our official topics.
Yes. Speaking of killing people, unfortunately, that was a really bad test.
All right, no, I apologize for laughing at that joke.
It brings up the Virginia Tech shootings, and, you know, a question that, I'm going to try to phrase this, I mean, you know, it's a tragedy, and we're already starting to see debates about gun control and about other issues, you know, improving campus security and so on and so forth. You know, the concern I have on all these things is whether or not, you know, from isolated events like this, from relatively rare events like this, you wind up trying to, you know, craft public policy that, I guess, overreacts. You know, in other words, you know, trying to think about this in the middle of a trauma is just not going to generate anything of use. And, you know, the point I was trying to make when I was blogging about this is that I'm not sure there's anything I can add or anyone else can add to the fact that this is just a tragedy.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, I said something about this on my site, which is that, you know, I don't have a problem with the idea of trying to use a story in the headlines, even if it's a tragic story, to, you know, advance some kind of policy aims, if they're good aims. But that, you know, well, I think sometimes something will happen. Like when John Corzine gets in a car accident where his injuries seem to have been worse than they would have been had he been wearing a seatbelt, right?
Then actually, not going 91 miles an hour.
Right. Both of those things. But, I mean, those are unusually high-profile instances of something that's actually quite common. I mean, people drive too fast. People don't wear their seatbelts. You know, so that, you know, kind of using this story to try and push for, you know, some kind of changes, right, could really do some good. Whereas, you know, a spree killing on a college campus is horrible. And it's obviously why it becomes such a big story. But it's also really, 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 really rare. I mean, it's just not the case that the United States in general has a substantial campus spree killing problem that, you know, needs to be addressed one way or the other.
Yeah. No, that's true, and hopefully that will continue to be the case.
Right.
And you're right, because there's a tension here. On the one hand, I mean, you know, if you study, you know, politics, John Kingdon, among others, talks about the idea of, you know, and I blogged about this, talks about the concept of the policy window, which is when you have a crisis or some sort of, you know, news hook, there is naturally an incentive for groups that want to promote public policy to take advantage of the news hook and say, all of this could be solved if we did policy X.
Hmm.
You know, and the problem, and I like the point that you make, that, you know, the problem is that there are sometimes events that, you know, are noteworthy because of who it happens to, but they're actually more, they're typical of a broader variety of a larger category of events. And then there are events that actually in some ways garner much more news attention, but are so garner news attention in part because they're so unbelievably rare.
Right.
And so, you know, you're right. And then the other problem is, you know, I've been talking about this with some other colleagues of mine. You know, the problem is when you have a story like this, you inevitably, there's a New York Times story today about this this kid, you know, this 23-year-old, you know, being moody and being, you know, withdrawn.
Right, sure. And there were warning signs. warnings.
Right. There were always warning signs. You know, the warning signs in this case was he wrote disturbing fiction.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently, you know, wore hooded sweatshirts and sunglasses all the time.
Right.
And was generally unresponsive. And, you know, my response to the hooded hooded sweatshirt and sunglasses all the time is that, you know, therefore, all poker players will therefore go on gun sprees by this sort of logic.
No, I mean, right. I mean, you know, I'm not at the moment because I'm on fake television, but, you know, while I've been working from home, I'm normally wearing hooded sweatshirts, and I have those glasses.
And sunglasses, really? That's interesting.
And I have glasses that automatically, you know, turn shaded if you walk out in the sun. So I can frequently be seen in a hooded sweatshirt and sunglasses, and I'm, to the best of my knowledge, I'm not, you know, on the verge of a spree killing. You know, precisely
okay, we got
because,
it on record. Good.
Yeah, I mean, precisely because, you know, the problem with these kind of warning signs is that, you know, to assess a contention like that, you need to know something about how many false positives are you
exactly.
Get,
it's
right?
Type 1 versus type 2 error. Yeah.
Right. I mean, how many moody loners are there on the, you know, aggregate college campuses of America? I mean, I have no idea, but it's probably a lot.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you know, most professors have encountered this at some point during their career, which is you encounter a student, you know, more than one student who, you know, they just ain't necessarily right. You know, and the problem is that they're unbelievably intense. They're, you know, they're not so, you know, they're socially awkward. The problem is, this actually describes a fair number of college students when they initially come to campus.
Mm-hmm.
And one could actually argue this has been an increasing, you know, this is an interestingly increasing problem. And this is actually something I'm surprised hasn't been talked about nearly as much, which is an increasing number of students are, you know, there's an increasing percentage of college students now that are diagnosed with psychological issues prior to attending, you know, coming on campus. Now, this mm-hmm. might be because psychological diagnoses on the whole have gone up, you know, as a secular mm-hmm. increase. But
or
I don't
colleges
see anyone
are admitting more crazy people.
Right, yeah, but, you know, suddenly, what's interesting is that I don't see anyone saying we need to have, you know, stronger filters to prevent, you know, crazy, you know, potentially crazy people, you know, from coming onto campus. And that actually is kind of surprising. Instead, you know, what issues I've seen talked about this is, you know, mostly the gun control one.
Right. Well, although I've started to see, because it does seem to be a more promising angle in that I read on Kevin Drum's site information that this wasn't just disturbing writing in a generic sense, but like it was actually so bad that I think his fellow classmates in some poetry class refused to attend. I don't know what was in that, but, you know, that does sound sort of like beyond kind of, you know, average angstiness.
No, and it's true. The problem is, you know, and part of this might be because you and I have unfortunately, you know, seen enough of these kinds of stories after Columbine, what have you, where, you know, the report is student seems, you know, seemed moody, isolated, withdrawn. It just so according to stereotype that you really don't know what to make of it at that point. I mean, you know, what's the difference between your garden variety, you know, socially awkward, isolated student and the really, really, really disturbed one?
Right. I mean, you know, because even like I knew someone in college who seemed moody, isolated, withdrawn. And one day he kind of snapped. And what he did was I think he like wrecked his bookshelf. You know, and threw broken pieces of it out the window. Which, I mean, was bad. You shouldn't destroy your own bookshelf. Pieces of wood could have hit some. You know, but it wasn't that
clearly
bad.
We need to have, you know, government
in the
registration
scheme
of bookshelves from this.
Right. Yeah, you know what, but I mean, right. I mean, which is just to say that, I mean, it seems really hard for me to say, you know, if you see someone who's clearly under, you know, having problems and under some kind of, you know, mental pressure or something. I mean, you know, how do you know which of those people are going to be the ones who kill dozens of people versus just, you know, have an irrational outburst of some kind? And it seems horrible to contemplate something like this falling on a spectrum with, like, I don't know, all other kinds of sort of, you know, acting out behaviors that people do, but the warning signs are just so similar to the warning signs for much more banal kinds of behaviors.
Right, and then, of course, so this is what the costs and benefits are. The costs, you know, the cost of not taking action, not reporting students like this, or you know, seeking, you know, aggressive treatment, and it appears that his name is Cho Sung-hui, apparently was admitted, you know, did receive treatment in 2005, in mm-hmm. part based upon sort of these stories, is that, first of all, the treatment might not work.
Right.
And second, you might be over-diagnosing. You might have students who, you know, they're going through a bad patch or, you know, they've simply been misinterpreted, and yet they're suddenly, you know, they're either forced to undergo this treatment, which actually could cause them, you know, cause some, you know, some sort of backlash, and therefore, paradoxically, you could easily see this kind of intervention actually creating the very behavior you're trying to prevent.
Yeah, I mean, right. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's tough. I mean, you know, and what I go back to is, I'm not sure exactly what the number is, but I mean, if you look at, you know, how many Americans are killed each and every year in spree killing, mass murders, right?
Yeah.
It's really few people.
Yeah.
It's just not, and so, I mean, obviously, one wishes this didn't happen. You know, it would be good to do things to make it less likely around the corner, but it's not systemically a problem, like, of the scale that justifies, I think, doing things that will have significant, you know, major costs and burdens on people.
Right.
It's not something like, I mean, whereas, you know, I mean, then on the other example, I mean, tons and tons and tons of people die in car accidents, you know, insofar as there are things we can do that would make, mm-hmm. you know, 4% decline in the number of automobile fatalities, that would be a huge gain, whereas...
Although that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that figure has actually gone down pretty persistently over the last couple decades.
Right, I mean, but precisely because, like, things... I mean, there's been real efforts to get there to be airbags and seatbelts in cars and people to wear them and to, you know, get people not to drive drunk and so on and so forth, and I mean, that's done a huge amount of good, whereas a comparable precipitous decline in the number of spree killings... would actually not save that many people.
Right. I mean, I saw an article in Time that suggested that some universities were considering, you know, one way to deal with this was to have, you know, to have, like, key cards that would allow, and, you know, I've seen this in campuses, you know, mm-hmm. to improve campus security where, you know, only students with ID cards can get into, you know, certain dorms and so on and so forth. And,
right.
You know, there's a part of me, and this is probably you know, we went to college during different about more than 10 years apart. You know, when I was going to school, you know, when I was going to school, we didn't have these kinds of things. And I have to admit, there's a part of me that's very sad that these things exist. But I'm not sure whether or not the benefit, you know, maybe perhaps the benefits outweigh the cost.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sure. I don't know. I mean, when I was in school, we had a key card system like that. So that I could get into, you know, my dorm.
And but you couldn't get into other dorms?
I couldn't get into other dorms. I think it was that I could get into other dorms sort of like during daytime, but not at night.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right, which seemed like, I mean... It never even occurred to me to think of that as, like, an anti-spree killing measure. But it seemed like a fairly reasonable sort of security-ish thing. I mean, treating, you know, the dorms like they were apartment buildings or whatever else. And that, you know, if you wanted to sort of come in, you had to have someone who lived there, you know, sort of de facto vouching for you. I mean,
I mean, those measures weren't designed to prevent sprees. I assume they were both anti-theft and also anti-rape devices. And, you know, God knows that's probably a good idea.
Right. And, you know, I mean, that all seemed reasonably prudent to me. I mean, so on some level, right, I mean, if certain college administrators are to use something like this as maybe a, like, pretext for making, like, worthwhile security changes, mm-hmm. you know, that's not such a bad thing. I mean... you know, for people to sort of just look twice at what it is they're doing, even though this specific problem, you know, is probably not worth overhauling all of your procedures for.
Mm-hmm. I was curious what you thought, by the way, of your colleague, Garance Fraki-Ruda had a post arguing that that the problem with the slow response in the Virginia Tech shootings was a failure to recognize domestic violence as a real issue. I mean, I was curious what your take was on that.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, my instinctive reaction to that was that it sounded very, very correct. I mean, as Grimes was pointing out, that one of the reasons that the Virginia Tech people sort of cited for why they hadn't put out a wider alert was that they mm-hmm. thought that these initial shootings were just a domestic incident.
Right.
And Grimes was saying, I mean, I think persuasively, that, you know, you have to recognize, like, you know... someone who's just gone and shot his girlfriend, which is what they thought had happened, and then is, you know, in points unknown, you know, is in fact a dangerous, violent person you need to be concerned with. Then someone else pointed out to me that the Virginia Tech campus is actually quite enormous. enormous, and that it's not clear to me. I mean, obviously, in retrospect, you whistling had been done, but actually, that seriously you had taken this initial incident, that, you know, I mean, trying to look at it without the benefit of hindsight, why would you shut down a 2,900-acre campus or whatever it was?
No, it seems to me, I mean, and the other problem is, I mean, as I read it, I don't think the Virginia Tech police, you know, the security was downplaying the first violent incident. It's that they didn't assume, what they didn't assume was, you know, most, you know, issues of domestic violence, cases of domestic violence, don't then escalate into spree-type shootings. And whereas, on the other hand, this one, you know, initially their interpretation was obviously wrong. So it's not just the cost of shutting down the campus. It's also what the expectation is of this sort of event, you know, that's an initial domestic violence one, then spilling out into a general spree. I didn't interpret the Virginia Tech explanation as saying we didn't take the initial shooting seriously. It's just they didn't think that the initial, you know, shooting was then going to lead to a lot more shootings immediately there afterwards.
Right. Well, but I mean, obviously, you know, nobody expects, you know, 30 people to get shot. It did strike me that the tone of it was that, like, they seemed to be implying that had their impression been that the first two people were just random people killed, then there would have been some kind of panic, but that because they were reasonably confident that there was somehow a domestic violence incident to these initial murders, that they felt that that made other people safe. Which goes to saying it's reasonably common for these kind of sprees to start out with something something domestic in nature. And that, you know, I mean, it does seem to be part of a, maybe a category on the part of law enforcement of not so much treating domestic violence issues less seriously than other kinds, but is treating them as sort of more distinct from like the underlying crime that, you know, that like not, it's not a murder, it's a like domestic murder, so
yeah.
So the rest of us can breathe safely.
Well, I think the problem is it depends how you look at it. If you're looking at it as how do you stop spree-style shootings, the problem might be that you, as you point out and Garanth might point out, a lot of spree-type shootings originate from killing people you know, at least initially, and then going on. The problem is that if you take a look at the overall universe of domestic violence cases,
sure, most
a very, very small percentage of those cases that take place then go on to spree-style shootings.
No, I mean, that's true. I think there are so few kind of, you know, mass murder incidents of this sort that it's really hard to reach any kind of conclusion about, you know, about prevention. You know, other than, I'm not, like, a gun controller myself. It is clearly true, I think, that if you had really, 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 really robust gun control, like in England, and that, you know, essentially nobody owned guns of any kind, that would reduce the number of these incidents. Since that's not going to happen, I don't think even, you know, I don't think the measures that people actually advocate for in the United States would make any kind of meaningful impact on this, just because it's so rare, so unpredictable, and I don't see how you can stop it.
Well, all right, I think we spent almost 20 minutes talking about something that we agree that really
right,
you can't do
enough.
Much that much about,
fair
so we
enough.
Should probably move on to something we should, you know, at least claim
right.
some
merit. Do we viciously disagree about Paul Wolfowitz?
Well, let me hear your take about Paul Wolfowitz and, you know, his plight at the bank. And let me put it this way. Do you think that Paul Wolfowitz, what's happening to Wolfowitz is simply emblematic of what happens to all of these books? You know, is it on parallel with what's happening to Gonzalez or, you know, the fact that this administration seems relatively incompetent across a wide variety of policy measures?
You know, in some ways, the Wolfowitz thing strikes me as a more banal instance of corruption that, you know, Wolfowitz was put, Fornden was put in a weird position, right, just being given this job where it was known that his girlfriend, or I guess companion, I've seen her called in the newspapers, was working, and so, you know, she had to go to a different job, and then, you know, naturally, right, there's a certain inclination to try and, like, misuse his authority, and help her out, but But the question is, like, why would you not misuse your authority in those circumstances? The reason you wouldn't is because, you know, I mean, you feel like the other people you work for and so forth are take this kind of thing really seriously. And I think the Bush administration in the whole, both in its conduct internally and in the way Wolfowitz wound up in that World Bank job, had just sort of really strongly signaled that, like, Wolfowitz was not going to get into any kind of trouble with the president, with anyone else, if he tried this sort of thing. That, you know, there's a real indifference to the World Bank,
I suppose,
and the institution, to corruption, that kind of thing.
I mean, I believe this way. I think I have more sympathy with Wolfowitz than certainly Gonzalez or, you know, any of the other sort of Brownie-style officials that the administration has come up with. Not necessarily to suggest that he should stay on. I think the problem is that Wolfowitz has managed to alienate both the bank staff and really powerful donors. And so, therefore, I don't think he's actually going to be able to do his job effectively.
Right.
You know, what? Matt?
No, I mean, I agree.
Yeah, okay. But that said, here's my question. The counterfactual is, let's say that Bush, instead of appointing Paul Wolfowitz as head of the bank, had appointed, you know, William Easterly, someone else who's, something of a skeptic in terms of aid, but certainly recognized as an expert. He had a long career at the bank,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so on and so forth. And let's say Easterly had a girlfriend, you know, in the exact same situation and gotten caught, you know, pursued the exact same policies that Wolfowitz had done, you know, and also been in the same sort of, you know, slight problem in terms of his girlfriend. I don't think there would have been the same calls to resign. You know, the fact is that there was incredibly bad blood, you know, bad blood about Wolfowitz from both European donors and the bank staff the moment he took this job.
Sure, but I mean, I think that bad blood was legitimate. I mean, and it was ridiculous to have appointed him to it in the first place. I mean, well, George Bush put Paul Wolfowitz in that job because Paul Wolfowitz was such a bad deputy defense secretary that he had to get him out of his administration. So given his record of failure in his alleged area of expertise, they put him in charge of an important institution that he has no expertise in because George Bush doesn't care about it. So,
I wouldn't go so far as to say he has no expertise, you know, on development. He's been concerned about these issues for some time. Now, I grant you, I mean, the way in which they did this was just idiotic. They never vetted Wolfowitz. You know, traditionally, the Treasury Department, you know, has the lead in terms of determining who the next World Bank president will be. And from what I remember, you know, when this happened, Treasury was never consulted. So that was just an idiotic move. And it was, you know, automatically two strikes against him the moment he went to the bank. So I grant you that. But on the other hand, I don't know, did you read the John Cassidy piece, the one in The New Yorker, came out about, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago about Wolfowitz at the bank?
You know, I think that was one of those pieces, like, I tell people I read, but I didn't. But it was brilliant, you know, all New Yorker profiles, brilliant.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's true. I got to read the Manny Ramirez one that's coming out, that's already out now. I mean, you know, I actually did read the piece. You know, the piece is, you know, a reasonably even-handed, you know, portrait of what Wolfowitz has done at the bank, where it's saying, you know, there are reasons why he's pursuing this anti-corruption initiative.
Sure.
You know, there are certainly valid reasons for doing it. The way he's gone about it has been somewhat ham-handed. And even this ethics charge in terms of his girlfriend, you know, if you actually read what happens, you know, the sort of chain of events, it's not like the bank board or the ethics committee comes off particularly well here either. Wolfowitz was very upfront at the beginning.
Right.
You know, he originally proposed an arrangement where he would recuse himself from dealing with her in terms of either salary or promotion. And then the ethics, you know, the bank board and the ethics staff said basically, no, that's not good enough. You need to get her out of here. And you go about figuring out how you're going to do that, which strikes me as a completely inane way of doing it.
I don't think Paul Wolfowitz should be, locked up in Fort Leavenworth for what happened here. But, you know, I think he should. And, you know, I think you can, while sympathizing, especially with Wolfowitz, right, who one doesn't get the sense that any of this was his first choice, like that he was really agitating to be sent to the World Bank in order to arrange this job for his girlfriend,
it's clearly
If you get sent to the World Bank and see him you know, on first blush to, like, not be the best choice for it, and were chosen through a suspect process, then you come in, you do some, you know, have a maybe defensible but controversial agenda that you're implementing in a somewhat ham-handed way, and that the content of that agenda is anti-corruption, and then you're caught up in some personal corruption, you know, even if being ham-handed isn't the worst thing, even if the corruption in question isn't the worst kind of corruption, even if not having been vetted properly isn't necessarily the worst thing, even if it was weird for the president to have picked someone who was guaranteed to piss off a lot of the donor community, you know, at some point it's like, you know, 12 strikes and you're out. I mean, and Paul Wolfowitz will be fine if he is forced out of the World Bank, right? I mean, it's not like he's going to end up, you know, penniless on the streets or something.
Oh, no, no.
And so, you know, so you put someone else in the job, the bank will probably be better off for it, and so will the world.
No, I mean, look, you know, I tend to agree he's got to go, in part because I don't think he's got a political base in which he can run the place. And plus, yes, you're right. If you're going to run, you know, look, if you're going to promote an anti-corruption campaign and then you're going to, you know, you're being asked to deal with this, you know, potential problem with nepotism, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, gee, this might come back to bite you in the ass. So, you know, I agree that Wolfowitz has committed some problems. You know, at the same time, even the African, you know, the African delegates came out in a statement saying, look, we actually like Wolfowitz. He's gotten us more money, you know, which last I checked was one of the jobs the bank is supposed to be doing. I guess the larger takeaway point I would take, I have some small measure of sympathy in wondering whether or not, I mean, in part, but Wolfowitz is complicit in this. In part, you know, the Bush administration has committed so many, you know, Category 5 clusterfucks that it's caused, you know, even their officials, you know, in other situations, when you have minor screw-ups, they get magnified way beyond belief. Now, they've brought this upon themselves. I agree with you on that.
Sure.
But there's a part of me that feels a little bit sympathetic to Wolfowitz on this point. I guess that's the way I would put it. And there have been previous blogging heads where, you know, everyone sort of said, yeah, he should go. I guess I think he should go, too, but there's still a little part of me that's sympathetic to what he was trying to do, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know Wolfowitz per se. I mean, I do agree that in general, because there's a sort of love of narratives out there, and that because of some examples, of really, really clear examples of Bush administration incompetence, that there's people are more eager to jump to the conclusion that everything that sort of happens there is like bungling rather than, you know, possibly something that's not that big a deal, which I guess is what maybe you're saying about Wolfowitz, or else something that, you know, whatever, then maybe incompetence isn't, like, the core of the problem you have here. I mean, for example, with Wolfowitz, I don't know much about, you know, the relevant issues. I mean, maybe Wolfowitz's anti-corruption agenda, like, is just a bad idea. He's wrong, and there's sincere disagreement between people, and that's part of why there's unhappiness about him. And I guess the Africa delegates say they, you know, they did like him. And, you know, I mean, it's always worth, you know, looking at these things on the merits and not just sort of like lazily assuming that because Katrina was such a clear, just sort of, you know, management fiasco, that, you know, that's every other complaint you have fits into that.
Yeah. You know, on the other hand, you know, on the other hand, as I said, they did bring this on themselves to some extent in terms of what, you know, what Bush has done, you know, during his first 6 years in office. So, and God knows Wolfowitz was complicit in that. So, you know, there is a little bit of being hoisted on your own petard.
Right. I mean, they were operating under a cloud of suspicion for a reason.
Yeah. I think, put it this way, the one closing note I would make on this is, you know, is when as we go to 2008, I think part of the Bush administration's, one of the real problems the Bush administration had when they initially came to power in 2001 was the belief that everything the Clinton administration had done prior to them was wrong and should be reversed. Not, you know, just you know, in some cases for purely ideological reasons, in some cases for purely personal distaste. Now, that turned out to be incredibly wrong on a whole variety of ways because, in fact, you know, the way, you know, at least in terms of foreign policy, a lot of government, you know, a lot of stuff is done. About 90% of what you're going to do in terms of foreign policy is not really going to change from administration to administration. And by trying to make these changes, they led to, there were some serious costs involved. That said, there's part of me that worries that, you know, a Democratic a Democratic, you know, president in 2009 is going to come to the exact same conclusion about the Bush administration's policies, you know, across a whole wide variety of areas. And there's going to be some areas where clearly there should probably be some shifts, but there's probably going to be some areas where they actually did have the right idea. And I'm concerned that they might fall down, you know, by the wayside in this sort of general conjecture of the Bush administration is incompetent.
Yeah, although, I mean, see, the incompetence notion has a special kind of valence to it that I think actually militates in the opposite direction, right? I mean,
okay.
If you decide that what makes your predecessor so hard, because right, I mean, I think what creates this phenomenon is that, I mean, in Bush's case, right, he's running against Al Gore, and Al Gore is very clearly sort of Clinton's successor. And to a lot of people, you know, the country seems fine in late 2000 or early 2001.
Yeah.
Peace, prosperity, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, you don't run against Gore and beat him unless you somehow psych yourself up into the belief that the administration you're displacing is, like,
it's
really
just,
bad in some sense.
Right.
You know... But so if what you can do, which I think is one of the things a lot of the Democrats are doing, is convince yourself that, like, what's so horrible about the people you're beating is just that they're incompetent, that opens up more room, I think in some ways more room than I would like, to decide that the other side's sort of basic policy aims aren't that fine and you want to do continuously, but just sort of bring in, you know, better people to do them.
Mm-hmm. No,
right, I mean, as opposed to if you decide, right, that, like, the problem with Bill Clinton is that he's weak and indecisive, and so therefore anything you do will be an improvement as long as you decide on it really, really fast.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I mean, and partly to be fair, you know, all administrations do this, particularly the first year of office, that, you know, the percentage of policy screw-ups that take place, you know, I was just teaching my class about this, that takes place in the first year of office is tremendous, in large part because even people who are considered seasoned hands, you know, once they take office, they think, oh, they can just apply their prior experience, when in fact the world has changed a fair amount since the last time they were in office.
Right.
And they're inevitably, you know, their own hubris is going to lead to certain kinds of mistakes.
Right. I think this is... Not to say this in too much of a partisan axe-grinding vein, but, I mean, I think if you look back at some of the sort of Richard Clark stuff, 9/11 Commission stuff that, you know, came out of this kind of unfortunate moment in the heat of the presidential campaign, but, like, in a kind of understandable but also obviously unfortunate light of what happened way, you know, new people come over, they think of themselves as seasoned experts. There are these kind of mid-level holdovers from the Clinton administration who are like, oh, hey, you know, Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, you got to do something about this. And their instinct is to just be suspicious of that because, like, that's not what they were doing the last time they were in government. They don't know who these other people are, why it is that they have this, like, weird obsession that's, like, the other guy's issue. You know, and so at the margin, when what you really ought to do is at the margin correct against your own bias, to ignore new things, you do go the reverse because you suspect the motives of the people who are trying to, like, get you up to speed on what's been happening most recently.
Mm-hmm. No. And this Clark in particular is a great example of this because, you know, Clark's reputation in Washington when the Bush people came in was as a master bureaucratic operator who liked, you know, accumulating power onto himself. He might have been he was absolutely right, as it turned out, on the issue. But the problem is that if you're Condi Rice or whatever, and you see this person saying, I need to maintain, you know, my status as being a policy principal on this issue, there's a natural, you know, hesitance to this sort of thing. You know, that unfortunately leads to a bad policy outcome, but it's also justifiable, I guess, would be the way to think, you know, without the hindsight bias.
Right, or at least, I mean, it's I don't know. Well, I mean, it seems endemic to the way the American government operates.
Yeah, it is.
And it's not really the best feature of it.
No, it's true. I'm not sure there's any way to fix it. Unless you have, you know, more people transitioning from administration to administration across party lines, this is just something that's going to be a function of the way the current system
works. No, I mean, exactly. But, I mean, I you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think... political appointees in America go sort of deeper into the agencies than they do in most countries, right?
It's also been on the increase. The Reagan administration in particular was sort of the ones who pioneered this idea as a way to make sure that what Reagan, you know, wanted done actually got implemented.
Right, but so like in England, I mean, obviously after an election, if there's a partisan switch, there'll be like a total turnover in the cabinet. But that turnover only goes like a couple people deep into every.
That's correct. Yeah.
Into every agency, whereas in America it can go like 7-8 down.
No, not seven. I mean, it's not 7 or 8 down. It'll go down usually to what's, you know, there's the cabinet level. There's deputy. There are undersecretaries. Assistant, I guess it's 5, yeah. Deputy assistant secretary is usually the level at which it'll stop.
Right. Well, then a lot of power's in the sort of, the White House staff.
Yeah, that's
too,
true. And that's,
right?
That is a complete turnover.
Right, and the White House staff is huge, much, much bigger than, like, a prime minister's office. I mean, it's a bigger country, too.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
No, this is you're right. This is it's an interesting issue. On the other hand, there are limitations to the European system as well.
I mean, there's reasons we do it this way. And, you know, Ronald Reagan. I'm not a huge Ronald Reagan fan, but the impulse to say that he wanted the government to, you know, implement the policies he'd been elected to implement, rather than
seems
pursue their
justifiable.
Own agenda, you know, seems perfectly justifiable.
Yeah. Although you can argue, I mean, this is another sort of tension that we're seeing with the debate about the U.S. attorneys. You know, is this question within the United States of to what extent should, you know, a government bureaucracy operate according to professional norms as opposed to political dictates?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, it's the, I don't know, I always think it's notable if you just talk to, like, read English newspapers or whatever, you know, so stuff about England, right, that the sort of the word the government and the word the state have very, like, clear and distinct meanings there. That the government is a small number of politicians who will be put in charge of the state, but that the state, you know, is a collection of agencies and bureaucrats and sort of has a logic of its own. And in America, you know, for a variety of reasons, that gets pretty murky. I mean, the U.S. attorneys are pretty deep in the trenches in sort of like the bowels of the federal apparatus to be direct presidential appointees.
Well,
it seems
they are presidential appointees, and also. I mean,
oh, no, 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 I mean, they are, but I mean, I think it's weird that they are.
Oh, I see.
They have, you know, it seems, just like it would be weird if the president was picking the heads of all the local FBI field offices, and, like, taking advice from his campaign contributors in the city where he was going to do it, and so on and so forth. Bush appears, I think, quite clearly to have, in this case, sort of taken the logic of having these people be political appointees to a place where it hasn't traditionally been taken.
No, that's a fair statement, yeah.
But the logic of what he did really is, as I guess, you know, because it doesn't defend him all that effectively, they haven't been willing to just say, like, well, look, you know, if you didn't want these offices to be abused, you shouldn't have made them presidential appointments in the first place. But, you know, I find that defense semi-convincing, not in the sense that the offices should be abused, but that, like, maybe this needs to be a little bit more, you know, bureaucratized.
Well, in some ways, though, I think it was bureaucratized. I mean, I think one of the ironies of this whole scandal is that, you know, it was the Bush appointees, because they were considered, you know, because they were professional lawyers and because they were professional prosecutors, they wound up not implementing what Bush wanted them to in terms of, you know, sort of partisan politics, focusing overwhelmingly on voter fraud, even if there was no evidence necessarily that voter fraud took place, for example. So I actually think this shows the limitations of the sort of the Bush approach or the American approach of trying to, you know, go incredibly deep in terms of appointing political staff, because at a certain level, you know, you hit professional, you know, there's a clash between political priorities and professionalization.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't matter which administration is in power in this sense. Partisan
power. I mean, I was joking with a friend last night that the lesson here seems to be that the Edwards administration needs to be really, really, really careful when screening its U.S. attorney appointments to make sure that they will manipulate the office for partisan purposes, you know,
exactly.
Up front.
No, you're right, yeah.
Because obviously you can't fire them in the back end. It's a joke because, like, the issue here is not the firing per se, but, like, the politicization of the prosecutorial function. You know, unfortunately, hanging Alberto Gonzalez, though something that I think should be done, especially since he, like, stuff he did in Congress, blah, 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 doesn't quite, like, get at the nub of the concern here, which is that you will have prosecutors acting on behalf of, you know, partisan imperatives rather than even policy ones, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because it's one thing to say, okay, the new administration judges, we need less sort of high-end fraud enforcement and more, more like election law stuff. You know,
right.
Okay, I don't know.
There was a great piece that Jack Goldsmith and Dahlia Lithwick wrote for Slate when the scandal initially broke that sort of got at the distinction between, on the one hand, you know, it's perfectly appropriate for presidents to set priorities in terms of prosecution,
right.
But the actual determining of what cases should be brought forward, so on and so forth, should be, you know, a professional determination and not a political one.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, you know, the priority can be we need to do more public corruption stuff. The priority can't be we need to do more public corruption stuff against Democrats.
Right. No, I completely agree on this. I mean, you know, otherwise, and I think one of the ironies of this is going to be, again, looking at 2009, there's going to be, I think it's going to be the same thing that happened, you know, after the Nixon administration left office, which is Nixon so politicized so many of the different, you know, functions of government, you know, getting the FBI to engage in domestic surveillance, that sort of thing. I think you're going to see a similar kind of backlash where presidents are actually going to be relatively restricted in terms of what they are going to be expected to, you know, in terms of running up against professional norms. So, you know, and it'll be interesting. I think one of the interesting sort of undercurrents in the campaign going forward is going to be how the Democratic candidates react to this. Because on the one hand, they obviously want the job, and the way to get the job as president is to bash Bush. On the other hand, once they get the job, they want all the perquisites that come with the job.
Right.
And paradoxically, Bush is you know, by screwing up so badly, is stripping them away one by one.
Right. Although, I mean, Democrats have less distrust of sort of the permanent bureaucracy than Republicans do.
That's probably true. I mean, on the other hand, though, I think there was an item in the Plank that Michael Crowley wrote about the Clinton, you know, the Clinton campaign and how it looked at campaign contributions by former Clintonistas to, say, Obama or other people. And, you know, it sounded, you could have replaced the word Clinton with Bush and it would have had that same kind of vengeful attitude.
Right. Well, except, what they were talking about there was like an intra-partisan, right, donors type thing.
That's true, but the point is that if it's the same kind of mindset in terms of, you know, there's friends and there's enemies, and we're going to go after the enemies as much as possible, you know, this makes me very nervous about a President Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah, well, that's, I mean, I'm not going to be voting for her.
Yeah.
I mean, I also thought, you know, this is weird. It's along the lines of what you said, but one of the various explanations her campaign has put out for why she was supporting the Iraq authorizing resolution was that, you know, she had sort of saw things from the White House point of view,
right,
and wanted presidents to be able to have that kind of authority if they asked for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is you sort of expect anyone, the longer they spend in the White House, to gain greater and greater appreciation for the virtues of executive power. The idea of someone who comes in sort of with the, like, this is, like, my ninth year in the White House kind of view about, you know, how expansive her powers need to be, does seem, a little bit distressing. Although, on the other hand, Congress is probably going to be much more active about this kind of stuff in the near future for sort of, you know, Nixon-type reasons, as you said.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's for institutional prerogatives. Well, that'll be interesting going forward. We should probably move on.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, we're running a little over. That was a fun conversation.
It was.
Okay,
speaking of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Okay, we were going to be talking about books.
Yes.
You know, I have one out called All Politics is Global, and, you know, I have a vested interest in not needlessly annoying, you know, regular watchers of Blogging Heads TV who have seen me pump this book, pimp the book, whatever you want to call it, you know, the last couple of times. So let's start off by talking about your book, which you're working on right now, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I've sent off the first draft to my editor. We've got
excellent
notes back and forth, you know, juices flowing. Our working title is The Untitled Matthew Iglesias Foreign Policy Project, which is also going to be the name of my prog rock band.
I was going to say, that does sound like a band name. Yeah. That's a good company.
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome one. Right, or also, yeah, right, like sketch comedy satire or something.
Right.
Yeah, so probably we'll get a title at some point. And, you know, this book is sort of a political history of the past few years, looking at the politics of national security in particular, sort of mostly looking at the kind of rise of the sort of liberal hawk movement in, mm-hmm. in the media and its influence inside the Democratic Party, and critique of that, both of the politics and the substance of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, to tie back to some of our earlier conversations, I mean, in particular, I worry that a lot of Democrats, not so much Democratic-based people, but Democratic politicians and people who'd be running this kind of thing, have reached the conclusion that the problem with George W. Bush's post-9/11 foreign policy has been that it's been incompetently executed, right, rather than that there are some actual errors that were made in terms of, you know, strategic priorities, what's important, what isn't, so on and so forth. And that, you know, this is a mistake, that it's not all that politically compelling, but, you know, more relevantly, certainly for our purposes, it's just wrong. It's a mistake to accept a lot of the strategic premises, notwithstanding the question of confidence.
Well, let me push you a little bit on this, because, I mean, I think you need to separate the larger questions about Bush foreign policy, and then there's Iraq, you know, which admittedly is a large component of this. I mean, you know, I'd be happy to debate you on the Iraq one, because, you know, I do still think the implementation mattered there, because if you look at the history of it, it was so catastrophically bad.
Sure, but, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, it's worth, obviously, abstracting from Iraq to some extent, because, yeah. I mean, nobody's going to invade Iraq a second time.
Right. But, I mean, all right, so if you're talking about the policy writ large, I mean, really, on the one hand, I mean, liberal hawks supported Iraq, and they supported the war on terror, but were liberal hawks really behind, you know, the entire gamut of Bush foreign policy, the whole gamut of Bush foreign policy approaches? I mean, you know, I just left I was involved somewhat marginally in this Princeton Project on National Security.
Sure.
That Anne-Marie Slaughter and John Eikenberry have led, which I would assume they would fall under the liberal hawk argument that you're making. But, you know, their emphasis is much more, you know, there's much more multilateralism in what they're talking about. They want to create this concert of democracies, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, so there was a lot they also disagreed with in terms of the Bush administration. But so is it the areas of agreement that still disturb you, or, I mean, are you...
Well, okay, so, I think the Princeton Project is a pretty good thing, that okay. I approve of large parts of it. And it sort of well encapsulates where I think the Democrats are vis-a-vis this argument, which is to say, in an ambiguous position. That a lot of the things that, for like the slogan of the Princeton Project, a world of liberty under law, seems like a great slogan to me. You know, not just as a slogan, but like it encapsulates what you need to do.
Yeah.
But that at other points, it just appears to me to give way too much ground to the conceit that somehow. The primary source of problems in the world is that the UN is, like, preventing the United States from launching all the wars we need, and so that we should have a community of democracies that can sort of alternatively authorize this stuff. You know, I mean, I know Bob has been on to debate this before, but that this... I mean, to me, it's wrong substantively, and also I think it's pretty transparent that this is like a kind of liberal internationalist effort to kind of me too neoconservatism and say, oh yeah, democracy's great, but so is multilateralism. So here's our multilateral democracy club. And that then, like, why exactly there should be a multilateral democracy club is not being well worked out. Now, I don't particularly fear the community of democracies concept, because I think it's nobody else is going to sign up.
Hmm. Well, the concert of the community of democracies was tried.
The concert of democracies idea, as outlined in that report, is just a non-starter. So it's sort of neither here nor there. But the thinking behind it seems confused and sort of ambiguous to me. That it doesn't. that, like, there were, I think most of the neoconservative criticisms you could make of that idea would be true, and then, like, also criticisms from the other end,
right.
That it's just this kind of, you know, it's this halfway house that's been adopted to sort of avoid, you know, confronting the issue squarely.
I think there are two issues that come up here. The first is whether or not it's a decent policy idea, and, you know, I'm happy to talk about that. But I'm curious whether your book also talks about the fact that I think politically the Princeton Project proposals are probably going to be a non-starter, in part because, you know, you're talking about the rise of liberal hawks. It's really about the rise and fall of liberal hawks, I think.
Right. Politically.
You know, I mean, and, you know, almost personified by Peter Beinart to some extent.
Yes, yes. No. Exactly.
And I got at this to some extent in a piece I wrote for the Washington Post back in December that sort of surveyed the possible grand strategies out there. And one of the conclusions I drew was that actually the grand strategy that will probably be the one favored by whoever comes into power is going to be one, the ethical realism one that Anatole Levin and John Hulsman put forward, largely because it's the one that requires the least amount of effort in terms of overseas, that it actually involves a retrenchment of, to some extent, of U.S. power, which is basically what Americans want at this point.
Right, although I'm not, I guess I agree with most of what you said, except for your confidence that that's necessarily the direction things are headed in. I mean, I think that the influence of public opinion on, you know, policy outcomes, especially in this area, gets pretty attenuated, and that...
Yes, absolutely, that's true.
They're, you know, and so that... I mean, so you see, for example, just Hillary Clinton's campaign right now, you know, appears to be the favorite to win the Democratic nomination. I think if she becomes the nominee, you know, the odds favor her winning. And I think that her rhetoric has certainly shifted to more sort of what the voters want to hear about this kind of thing, because, you know, she's not, like, an incompetent politician. You know, but that her I think her personal instincts and those of the people she would try and put into office is not that the voters correctly think we need some measure of retrenchment from the grandiose goals of the Bush administration, but that what they think is that you need just put smarter people in charge of those grandiose goals.
My take is slightly different. I mean, you're correct that sort of historically there's been a long, you know, there's a divorce between what the public wants in terms of foreign policy and what elites, you know, want and what foreign policy actually looks like. And, you know, Benjamin Page has a whole book on this point called The Foreign Policy Disconnect. The thing I would point out, however, and suggest is that because of Iraq, I think we're actually in an exceptional period on this point. You know, I think you can point to the 2006 election, and I think you're going to see it come up in the next election as well, which is because Iraq is so paramount in people's minds when we, you know, think about what the issues are, you know, in the next campaign. Candidates are going to be held, you know, their feet are going to be held to the fire much more so than in the post-Cold War elections in recent years about what their foreign policy, you know, positions are going to be.
Right.
And so I think this is a case where what they say during the campaign really actually will, you know, affect what they're going to do in terms of policy. And I think the things that are going to resonate during the campaign are proposals that basically say the U.S. has, you know, the U.S. no longer needs to be the world's policeman. You know, it breeds resentment elsewhere. You know, we need to stay actively involved in world affairs. We have to do our share. But, you know, we need to cut a slightly lower profile because this is what America wants and this is what the rest of the world wants. In fact, there was a poll that just came out today on this point.
Right.
I think that World Public Opinion did. Yeah, the PIPA and World Public Opinion did. Mm-hmm. Saying this is what, you know, Americans and everyone else wants. So
right. That's more or less what I want, and I certainly, you know, I mean, I hope with the book when it comes out, and you know, on my blog and whatever else day to day to help perhaps spur those changes. I mean, I guess I'm not
You're
sure
a
you
change
would regard.
Agent. I like it.
If I thought what you thought, that would be an optimistic point of view from my perspective. I mean, I found it. Noteworthy, though, that, you know, so far in the campaign, the candidates have all, I think, tried very hard to sort of, you know, get on the right side of public sentiment about this kind of thing, but have also, but, you know, mostly by kind of avoiding the issue. So that, like John Edwards, right,
yeah.
who's famously, you know, endeared himself to the hearts of the left for
right.
a variety of reasons, but to do that he had to disavow his Iraq war vote. But if you read his op-ed in which he did that, and if you read, you know, his speeches, his words on it, he's very specifically making a point about the quality of the intelligence that he had.
Right.
He's not making a point about the wisdom of unilateral preventative military action as an approach to nonproliferation policy.
Well, this actually, I think, ties back into our initial, you know, what we were talking about before, which is President, you know, the difference between what presidential candidates have to do or say to get elected,
mm.
and then the what presidential candidates, the prerogatives of power they want once they come into office,
right?
Which is, you know, and so, you know, we've nicely tied this back to our initial point. You know, I mean, you're right. Part of this is that no president wants to say, you know, no candidate wants to lock themselves in a position that therefore constrains them overly, you know, too much. Once they come into office.
Right. No. I mean, exactly. But, I mean, so yeah. I would hope that, you know, our activists and so forth, you know, will sort of do their part to try and, you know, make people do what they're disinclined to do.
Well, this will be an interesting tension, I think, as the campaign goes forward. So I agree with you on that. When is your book supposed to come out? I'm just curious.
It's a little up in the air at the moment.
Ah, okay.
We'll see.
I assume you want to come out before the 2008 election, though.
Yeah, no, that would be the goal. I don't really want to try and, like, negotiate via blogging head segment, though.
Fair enough.
You know, I think that, yeah, it might get inappropriate. But, yeah, so all politics is global?
You know, as I said, the
have you seen that giant parking structure near the LYT stop that Tip O'Neill had built?
Yes.
That shows that all politics is local.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the play on the that's obviously the play on the title. But
right.
You know, the arguments I'm making in the book actually are, to some extent, the arguments I make in the book in terms of what we were just talking about is that the fact is, you know, in a world where increasingly, even though we might want to retrench a little bit, there's an increasing number of issues that have to be dealt with at the global level.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the U.S., it's obviously in the U.S.'s interest to throw its weight around, and to some extent that's a good thing because, you know, to some extent the argument I make in the book is that market power matters. So basically you're going to have, you know, effective global governance if you can get the U.S. and the EU to agree on things. That was the point I made in the book, but the you know, going forward, I'm a little more skeptical in part because, you know, during the period that I studied, it was a nice bipolar distribution of power between the U.S. and the EU, whereas
right.
going forward, you're going to have India, you're going to have China, you're going to have more and more states. It becomes a more multipolar world. And interestingly enough, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, multilateralists like Eikenberry and Slaughter and the Princeton Project want to see this, you know, increasing number of multilateral institutions. And one of the things I'm going to argue going forward is that, in fact, an increasing number of multilateral institutions isn't necessarily going to lead to more of a rule-based world.
Right, it dilutes the ruliness of the rules.
Say that again. The what?
It makes the rules less like real rules.
It makes the rules less like it makes it possible to form shop among the different rules.
Right.
You know, and so it becomes ever more confusing, which takes place at the domestic level as well. Except in the domestic level, you have administrative courts and other procedures to sort of eventually, you know, adjudicate between them. Whereas at the global level, you don't. And so, you know,
I agree with that.
Right, and this is part of the problem I have with Bob Wright's proposals, you know, about sort of larding the WTO with more and more rules. I don't think, first of all, it's never going to happen because a majority of countries in the WTO are going to oppose it for a variety of reasons. What this is leading, incidentally, is to the United States and the European Union actually trying to get these rules implemented at the bilateral level. And sort of regional trade agreements. But this actually leads to an erosion, potentially, over time of what the WTO can do. And so there's very complicated effects here, and I'm not sure, you know, I need to, this is sort of also going to be the subject of the next book for me as well. What happens when you try to create sort of a new, you know, set of institutions? overlapping a whole set of old pre-existing institutions that are perceived to be somewhat dysfunctional.
Yes, that's a good question.
Right, but that's going forward.
And a difficult one. I guess. No, you know, I mean, you know, I think that's true, and I mean, especially get something. I guess I feel a little bit better informed about, but yeah, that the impulse by multilateralists. One of the things you see from a lot of people is the idea that, well, if international institutions are good, then more institutions must be better.
Right.
Which I don't think is correct. I mean,
no,
it doesn't.
It's not necessarily true. What you want are coherent.
I think it's actually a lack of understanding of, well, like, why institutions might be good.
Yeah. No, that's largely correct. I mean, you know, but there again, there's paradoxical effects, unfortunately, because from a U.S. perspective, sometimes you want to create new regimes because it actually allows you to advance your interests.
Right.
The interesting question is going to be over the long haul what the effects of this are. And you know, this gets back to the concept of democracies idea that's being put forward. Let's assume for the moment you could actually do that. You know, the problem, of course, is that countries like China are then going to respond by creating concerts of non-democracies.
Right, right. No. I mean, you know, this is what I remember a kind of incident when you know I got to talk to John and Marie about this, and Anatole Levin was saying in a very agitated way to them, like, why did they want to start a Cold War with a like Russia-China bloc?
Yeah.
And they were sort of denying that's what they wanted to do. I guess it's not what they want to do, but like that's what.
But
would
it could
happen.
Be what actually happened. No, I agree. This is the interesting thing. I think the only way you can actually counteract that, there might be a way to counteract it, but the way to counteract it is again a weird thing where I think you would actually have to create more institutions. Which is, if you create a concert of democracies, but you also create a new institution that allows for, you know, let's say, you know, a new version of the G7 or G8 that basically brings China in, you know, and brings other non-democracies but powerful states, you know, in terms of the economy, and bring those into a new club. You know, I mean, the G20 is what,
I mean, specifically, it seemed to me like the red line in the concept of democracies as they outlined it was that there's something in that report about how, you know, if the Security Council doesn't adopt, like, X,
right.
Y, and Z reforms, that they want to say that the concept of democracies can, you know, authorize the use of force in the spirit of the UN Charter or something.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
To me, I mean, I think that's obviously like a non-starter. That you're better off if you want to use force without Security Council authorization, just by doing it.
I have to disagree.
It's
with
really
that,
pressing them to. I think that to try and say that you're formally institutionalizing an alternative source of authority that is explicitly designed to exclude China and Russia.
Isn't that NATO?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think it is. I mean, I don't think NATO, you know, like, NATO doesn't say in its charter, like, we can just attack other countries, and that's international law.
No, it doesn't, but I don't think the concert of democracies would necessarily say that in their charter either. You know, I mean, no one would be so stupid as to be that explicit.
I guess to say, you know, with NATO, right, I mean, I think it was relevant that, like, NATO's big actions all happened in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
To, like, why it worked. That, not explicitly, right, but implicitly, there was something of a, you know, this is our corner.
Right.
You know,
I mean,
kind of attitude to it. And also Russia, I mean, Russia was also just really, really weak back then, and one could afford to completely ignore what they thought, in a way.
And even then, they sent paratroopers to Pristina after the operation took place.
No, I mean, it didn't go smoothly. But, you know, Russia's recovered economically. They have all this oil, blah, blah, blah. I mean, pragmatically, it has to be, you know, dealt with a little more seriously than it did in 1998, which was sort of the nadir of Russian influence in the world.
No, it'll be an interesting question going forward. But unfortunately, I think we got to wrap up now.
Sure, yes.
But I'm sorry to cut it off like that, but I know we were supposed to upload this relatively quickly. But
no, you're right.
You know, very pleasant conversation.
Yes, thank you.
And good luck with the book.
Thank you.
All right, take care.